The Diameter of the Bomb by Yehuda Amichai.
The diameter of the bomb was 30 centimeters, and the diameter of its effective range about 7 meters, with 4 dead and 11 wounded. And around these, in a larger circle of pain and time, 2 hospitals are scattered and 1 graveyard. But the young woman who was buried in the city she came from, at a distance of more than 100 kilometers, enlarges the circle considerably, and the solitary man mourning her death at the distant shores of a country far across the sea includes the entire world in the circle. And I won't even mention the crying of orphans that reaches up to the throne of God and beyond, making a circle with no end and no God.
Portraits from the collected Portraits of Grief from the New York Times. Eli Chalou. Fluent in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, Eli Chalou, 23, moved easily among the diverse communities to which his languages gave him access. He spoke Arabic at home, of course. He moved here with his family from Damascus, Syria, when he was 14. At his new job at the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance in the World Trade Center, he spoke Arabic with his Egyptian colleagues, who got a kick out of him. Mr. Chalou was not Muslim. He was a Syrian Jew who learned Hebrew at the yeshiva he attended in Brooklyn. America was a country he wanted to wrap his future around. He was always in a rush, determined to cram every moment with English studies and other courses. He was so disciplined that he allotted himself only 15 minutes of television at night. His efforts were beginning to pay off. He had just graduated with near-perfect grades from Long Island University, a member of the Honor Society, and voted by the faculty the most outstanding accounting student of 2001. Industrious, yes, but enormously sunny and engaging as well. Whatever you asked him, he would do, and whatever you wouldn't ask, he would volunteer to do, said a supervisor at work, Eddie Yeager. He was an unbelievably nice kid.
Evan H. Gillette. Sherry Partridge, a native New Yorker, had been searching for the right man for years, and at 39 she found Evan Hunter Gillette. They met on the internet. "We just really hit it off," recalled Ms. Partridge, a publicist working downtown. Mr. Gillette, 40, was a vice president at Sandler O'Neill & Partners. After a few dates last year, the two moved in together and spent weekends in Canada, Vermont, Washington, and Monticello, Virginia. "We did a lot of bed and breakfast," she said. "We walked hand in hand, lay on the grass, and took it all in." A wedding was in the offing. The couple roamed the streets of Manhattan looking for the right rings and talking about babies. "We were very, very happy," she said. Before the attack, Ms. Partridge says, she had a dim prescience of what was to come. "Sometimes I woke up in the middle of the night and had this gripping fear that he might die," she said. "I would tell him, 'Please don't die, please don't die.' And he would tell me, 'I'll never leave you.'"
Telmo Alvear. At 25, Telmo Alvear, who emigrated from Ecuador as a teenager, was assembling the pieces of a good life. His son, Stephen, had just turned 1. His wife, Blanca, was studying computerized accounting at a Midtown technical college. And in August 2001, he quit a busboy job to become a waiter at Windows on the World for much higher tips. He liked serving fancy meals and was beginning to learn about wine. Off duty, Mr. Alvear was usually at home with his family in Queens, watching soccer on television or cooking dinners of seafood or pasta for relatives and friends. On weekend afternoons, he joined his team at Flushing Meadows, Corona Park, for some hard-hitting volleyball. When he and his friends went dancing with their wives and girlfriends, he would make a point of dancing with as many of the women as he could. Mr. Alvear was assigned to the night shift at Windows on the World, but on Monday, another waiter told him he could not make the breakfast shift, and Mr. Alvear agreed to cover for him. The friend promised to return the favor soon.
Stephen J. Bates. Although Stephen J. Bates liked the solitude of athletic competitions like running, swimming, and bicycling, he was a team player, period. That was why he worked for 18 years as a New York City firefighter. The lieutenant liked the way firefighters relied on one another while sticking to their vows to save lives and put out fires. Most of all, Lieutenant Bates liked the automatic brotherhood of the job. It gave him the family he always wanted. His mother died when he was 15, and he was estranged from his father, said his girlfriend Joan Pawalski. He frequently took family-style dinners with the firefighters at his station house, Engine Company 235 in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. He liked cooking family dinners for the gang. Sauerbraten was his best dish. The other members of his family were two big dogs who lived in the home that he shared with Ms. Pawalski in Glendale, Queens. Samantha, 8, a 105-pound yellow Labrador retriever, and Norton, 8, an 85-pound mutt. He called them his babies, Ms. Pawalski said. Sometimes the four of us would sleep together in our queen-size bed. That was a squeeze, considering that Lieutenant Bates, 42, was a big man, standing exactly 6 feet and weighing 235 pounds.
David's Lament, from 2 Samuel, chapter 1, verses 19 through 25.
Thy beauty, O Israel, is slain upon your high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. You, mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. Saul and Jonathan were loved and dear in their lives, and in their deaths they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet, with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of battle?
Stories of Heroism and Resolve from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, New York Newsday, and the New York Times.
This is an account of an event that occurred on September 11, 2001, when four men boarded United Airlines Flight 93, intending to blow up the aircraft full of passengers along with themselves. The passengers, knowing that they would lose their own lives, overpowered the terrorist hijackers. The entire aircraft and its passengers were destroyed. From the back of Flight 93, Cece Lyles finally reached her husband, Lorne. "Babe, my plane's been hijacked," she said. "Huh? Stop joking," he said. "No, babe, I wouldn't joke like that. I love you. Tell the boys I love them." The pair prayed. In the background, Lorne Lyles could hear what he now believes was the sound of men planning a counterattack. "They're getting ready to force their way into the cockpit," she told him. When he had finished talking with Lisa Jefferson, finished relaying his love for his family, finished praying the psalm that asked for green pastures and still waters, Todd Beamer put down the phone, still connected with the outside world. "Are you guys ready? Let's roll," he said. Anna Arwenio was still on the line with her stepmother. "I need to go," she said. "They're getting ready to break into the cockpit. I love you. Goodbye." "Everyone's running to first class," Andy Bradshaw told her husband. "I've got to go. Bye." Cece Lyles let out a scream. "They're doing it! They're doing it! They're doing it!" she said. Lorne Lyles heard a scream. Then his wife said something he couldn't understand. Then the line went dead. 45 seconds after telling Supervisor Dennis Fritz to evacuate the Johnston Tower, Cleveland Air Traffic Control phoned again. They said to disregard. The aircraft had turned to the south, and they lost radar contact with him. It was 10:06 a.m. Fritz and Controller Thomas Hull studied the horizon to the south. They couldn't see a thing.
Will Jimeno, 32, was one of the last two people to be pulled out of the World Trade Center alive. Jimeno was a rookie with 9 months on the job when he left the Port Authority bus terminal with a group of four other officers and headed for the burning trade towers. They were putting on their helmets and air packs in the mall area near the huge globe, preparing to enter Tower 1 when Tower 2 collapsed, caving in the ground beneath their feet. Two of the officers with him, Antonio Rodriguez and Christopher Amoroso, were killed. Jimeno, Dominic Pizzullo and Sergeant John McLaughlin were buried 20 feet down, Jimeno said. McLaughlin's legs and the entire left side of Jimeno's body were crushed by falling debris. Pizzullo, Jimeno's classmate from the police academy, was able to dig himself out. He went to Jimeno and was trying to dig his friend out when Tower 1 collapsed, causing a concrete wall to collapse onto Pizzullo. With his dying words, Pizzullo told Jimeno, "Will, don't forget me. Just remember I died saving you guys." With that, Pizzullo shot his gun through an opening in what Jimeno said was a last-ditch effort to say, "Hey, we're here." Pizzullo then slumped over and died. While he was pinned, Jimeno said the thought ran through his mind that he wouldn't make it out of that hole, that he would never see again his wife, Allison, their daughter, Bianca, or the daughter who was due to be born in a few months. He told McLaughlin that if he didn't make it, then tell his wife that he wanted their newborn to be named Olivia, a name he happened to like. About 10 hours after he was first buried, rescue workers found Jimeno. It took another 3 hours to free him, and it took nearly three times as long to free McLaughlin, who spent a total of 22 hours buried. Jimeno spent 3 months in the hospital and rehabilitation center and now undergoes intensive therapy 3 times a week. His daughter, Olivia, was born on his birthday, November 26th.
This is the story of John Paul DeVito, chief operating officer of May Davis Group, a small investment bank located at One World Trade Center, and Harry Ramos, the head trader with the same firm. They were two ordinary people among the thousands caught in the World Trade Center, and like countless others, they were thrust into chaos and forced to make extraordinary choices. One chose to lead his own staff out of the building, troubled as he did so by the thought that he was abandoning his duty to safeguard the firm, even answer the phones. The other chose to stop and try to save the life of a stranger. Today, one is at home, ecstatic about life itself, and wondering how he could have dreamed of staying at his office command post instead of guiding his staff down the stairs to safety. He is, he says, a different person, able to recognize the courage and selflessness in regular people. The other is missing in the rubble, memorialized in the constant tremble in the voices of his family and friends. DeVito was just sitting down to some paperwork and a second cup of coffee after meeting with a client. Ramos, just back from a week's leave after the death of his mother-in-law, was exchanging greetings with his assistant. Then, at 8:48 a.m., their building, One World Trade Center, lurched violently like a ship in high seas. Mr. DeVito was nearly knocked off his chair. Mr. Ramos braced himself in a doorway. Neither Mr. DeVito nor Mr. Ramos realized there was a gaping gash in the glass and steel just above them where a Boeing 767 had slammed into the building. All they knew was that their office was filling with smoke. Mr. DeVito ran for the elevator bank. He opened the door to an incomprehensible sight. Where there had once been other offices, there was now just a huge void, full of fire and smoke. "What am I doing?" Mr. DeVito suddenly asked himself. "Get back in there, get the employees." He ran back into his office suite. Some thought that they should stay. Others agreed to leave but wanted to gather their things. But which things? What to take down 87 floors? Everybody made for the stairs except for Hong Zhu, an investment banker, who was frozen with fear. He told the others he would wait for help. Mr. Ramos cajoled him to the stairwell door. Then Mr. DeVito had misgivings. Should he lead his employees down to safety or stay? He decided to take the lead in going down. The others formed a human chain behind him, each putting a hand on the shoulder of the person in front, and descended into the gathering smoke. Back on the 53rd floor, Mr. Zhu was trailing far behind. He saw his firm's head trader, Mr. Ramos, leaning over a very heavy man named Victor, who seemed unable to move. Mr. Zhu stopped, wanting to help. "Why don't you lean on both of our shoulders?" Mr. Zhu suggested. They helped Victor to his feet and struggled with him down one flight. Then Mr. Zhu saw that the elevator appeared to be working. They descended to the 44th floor, but there it stopped. they started struggling down the stairs again. When Mr. Ramos went ahead to scout, Victor cried out in fear. "Harry, please help," he begged. "Don't worry, we're not leaving you," Mr. Ramos said. On the 39th floor, Mr. Ramos spotted an open door, a credit union. They decided to go in and rest. Just then, they felt the building shake again. They jumped back onto their feet and trudged down to the 36th floor, but then Victor gave up. "I can't move my legs anymore," he said. "Don't move your legs," ordered Mr. Zhu. "Sit down and move your butt." He sat and tried bumping down step by step, but soon gave up again. Another fireman, hurling curses, told them to leave Victor and get out of the building. Mr. Zhu continued down, but heard Mr. Ramos behind him saying, "Victor, don't worry, I'm with you." Below on the plaza, Mr. DeVito had by then emerged with what was left of his group. His employees thanked him, but he felt so bad about not knowing where everybody was that he considered himself unworthy. Then a roar. The neighboring 2 World Trade Center was collapsing. Soon afterward, the other tower toppled, and no one has seen Mr. Ramos since. As everyone on the ground began screaming and fleeing, Mr. DeVito was engulfed by smoke and dust. Mr. DeVito was glad to be alive, glad he had decided to help others to safety, thrilled to have watched other ordinary people performing simple acts of courage under tremendous pressure. "If you had seen what it was like in that stairway, you'd be proud," he said later. "There was no gender, no race, no religion. It was everyone, unequivocally, helping each other." In the days since, Mae Davis employees have spent their energies checking in with one another, meeting at homes to exchange stories. Most of all, they have been calling the city's hospitals and checking the lists of Trade Center survivors, trying to find Mr. Ramos.
Psalm 23.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. You allow me to lie down in green pastures. You lead me beside still waters, you restore my soul. You lead me in right paths for your name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of death's shadow, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord my whole life long.
A meditation before saying Kaddish, adapted from the words of Shai Agnon.
God cares for each individual life. God mourns, as it were, each person. When a person dies, God's own name is diminished, God's own sanctity lessened. God's kingdom experiences a terrible vacancy. God suffers, as it were, just as the human mourner suffers. When we recite Kaddish, we offer God consolation for this loss. We say Yitgadal, your name has been diminished. May it be magnified. Yitgadash, your sanctity has been lessened. May it be increased. Yamlich Malchutei, your kingdom has suffered a sudden loss. May it reign eternally. Before reciting the Kaddish, let us reflect on our loss and the source of all growth and goodness. Let us reflect on praising God who stands beside us as a mourner and who also is the promise on which we build tomorrow.
Yit gadal v'yit kadash shemei rabah, b'yoma divra chirutei, v'yamlich malchutei, b'chayechon v'yomechon, b'chayei d'chol beit Yisrael, b'agala u'vizman kari v'imru amen. Yehei shemei rabah mevorach le'olam ulomei olmaya. Yitbarach, vishtabach, vitpa'ar, vitromam, vitnase, vitadar, vitale, vitalal, shmei dekusha, brichu. Leila minkol birchata, vishirata, Tushbechata v'nechemata, Damiran be'alma v'imru amen. Yehe shlama rabba min shemaya, V'chaim aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael v'imru amen. Oseh shalom b'imromav, Hu ya'aseh shalom, Aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael v'imru amen.